Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
So, Brad Hayes, the last time we spoke, we talked about McCutcheon decision, the Supreme Court's decision, which basically extended their earlier work on Citizens United and holding spending money equivalent to having your beliefs presented and protected by the First Amendment, I would guess. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about what money actually buys in politics. What do you buy with it?
Well, I mean, you can buy any number of things. Influence, obviously, is the one that we hear the most readily in the sense that you can influence politicians, you can influence the elections, but all of that is going to have a kind of an aggregate effect on the creation of public policy. Mm-hmm. So the large amounts of money that we could expect to begin to flow into politics from a very small number of individuals, kind of a reference point, we know that only a small number of people in past election cycles have maxed out. In other words, they've spent the maximum amount. It's a little over 2,000 individuals in the last electoral cycle. We could expect a small number of people to max out and then to have a kind of a disproportionate amount of influence in terms of the development of public policy. So that's always the kind of concern when you hear about the need for campaign finance.
I've known million of politicians, it seems to me, in my life. And let me tell you something. Even if they don't get money from rich people, a rich guy wants to come in and talk to them and gets in the door and has that access.
Yeah, and obviously this is, I think, part of the growing concern about the money in politics and the larger critique of the 1%, right, that we're kind of moving towards a plutocracy where the affluent have access to, those with power in our political system in a way that the rest of us don't, and that their interests might be quite a bit different from the interests of the lay voter, right? And there's another concern here, too. Which speaks also to the McCutcheon decision, and that's the issue of corporate spending in campaigns, right? This is about individuals, but the court, I think, has made it clear that, you know, bans on corporate contributions to candidates, whether that's at the state or the national level, are now suspect. And it's likely that the court is going to look at that in the near future about, you know, kind of bans on corporations. And so we could then not only see affluent individuals be able to spend, but also then form corporate entities that could then spend. And we've seen what that means in terms of kind of direct speech. Citizens United, well, we might have a similar effect if the Supreme Court were to strike down the bans on corporate contributions.
Yeah. I just spoke with a fairly rich man who said to me the other day, a generous and very decent guy, who said to me the other day, this is going to cost me money because there were limits on how much he could spend. But now, and the phone is ringing all day long. And by the way, the politicians themselves make these telephone calls to these rich guys. They dial for dollars all the time. And so now he says, look, they're going to be on the phone and they're going to be asking for more. In the old days, I could hide behind the limits.
Right, right. And we are going to see this. And one of the interesting things about, you know, who benefits from this is, you know, that we don't really know yet because we're not sure who's going to be willing to open up their pocketbooks in order to increase the amounts that they're spending. Because you're right. In the old days, you used to be able to kind of hide behind the spending caps and say, OK, well, I'm tapped out. I can't continue.
Yeah.
You can do that now. There is a ceiling that you hit, but it's a much higher ceiling. You're talking about, less than $200,000 under the old scheme. And now you're talking about, you know, close to $3 million, right? So that's a big jump forward. And to do that each electoral cycle, and that's just at the national level, let alone when we talk about state level, if in fact some of these state caps that currently exist. So, for example, in New York, there are caps on individual donations to candidates and committees that is, I think, $150,000 per calendar year. And actually, corporate contributions are allowed in New York, but it's a very small number. I think it's $5,000 per calendar year.
And what's the court had to say about state laws?
It hasn't yet. It hasn't spoken about them yet, but there doesn't seem to be, for First Amendment purposes.
Yeah,
the First Amendment is incorporated against the state, so it's supposed to apply the same. There seems to be no reason why those caps would continue to exist. So, in other words, the federal candidates and state candidates should be treated basically the same. I expect the court to, bring that into the law in the very near future.
Anything else that you want to tell us about all of this?
Well, I think it means a bunch of things for campaign finance reform in the future, right? The court obviously is attempting in some ways to deregulate the campaign market. And we know that the governments, both state and national.
But it's not surprising, Brad Hayes, that the five votes are the Republican votes on the court as opposed to the four Democratic votes.
No, I mean, they've been at this for a while now, right? They've been chipping away. So we know that that they've been doing this, and they're likely to do it for other things. So for example, I think individual contribution caps to candidates, those are now suspect and are likely to go. Individual party donations, the caps that limit those are now constitutionally suspect. You also wonder about soft money bans. If those will be tossed out, et cetera, et cetera. So they're really trying to deregulate here. But the court has been, I think, even to move beyond that. They've attacked spending regulations, as we've been discussing. But they've also done some work on undermining public financing. In a past decision, for example, coming out of Arizona, they had in place essentially an escalation so that if, in fact, somebody spends, candidate X spends beyond a dollar amount and candidate Y is taking public money, he can go beyond the cap if, in fact, his opponent goes beyond that cap. And that's through public money so that you won't get outspent.
And the court said?
And the court said that's unconstitutional because what that does is it suppresses speech. It creates a disincentive for the other candidate to speak through advertising and the expenditures of money.
Well, but it's always been a country of rich men, rich white men in the past, and now rich people. And, why are we so surprised that this majority is going in this way?
Well, I think part of it is, I don't know if it actually is surprising right now as much as it is alarming in the sense that, you know, for folk like myself, middle-aged, approaching middle-aged, throughout our...
You are not middle-aged. I'm 72 and I'm middle-aged.
All right. Then for a healthy chunk of your life, right, there has been a kind of robust regulatory regime in place, and that is being peeled away. And the politics have been constitutionalized. So you can think about efforts at reform here, right? I mean, how do you change the court's ruling for public financing? How do you change it for spending regulations?
You get five Democrats on the court.
Well, I would say there are only two ways, right? Personnel change on the court through the five-member majority, which, by the way, is not likely to happen anytime soon.
No, not in our time.
Or the politics of constitutional amendment. And what we know about
That ain't going to happen either.
Article 5 amendment is extraordinarily difficult. It's like, in some ways, it's one of the deficiencies of our constitutional system is that it's almost impossible to amend the Constitution. By the way, I mean, if you look at the public opinion polls, there's 80% support for campaign finance
reforms.
Sure,
because they're not the 1% who have it all.
Well, and I think that's right. So in theory, then constitutional amendment should be on the table, but it's just institutionally so difficult.
The people who are sitting in the legislatures aren't going to vote for what is bad for them, which is their incumbent. So we have something called the IPP, or Incumbent Protection Plan, and this all fits in very nicely.
Right, which then leaves the last option, and those are disclosure laws, right? And disclosure laws are the last way the governments have attempted to regulate campaign finance.
Sunlight is the best antiseptic.
Right, and I've always been a bit skeptical as to that notion, just in part because we've had these rules in place for lobbying, and it really hasn't affected lobbying dramatically. But this is, in many ways, what's left on the table after the court. And that doesn't leave us with a lot of tools to attack this problem in our campaigns.
Professor Brad Hayes is Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College, our professor in residence, holds a PhD in government and politics from the University of Maryland. And we're always delighted, Brad, to have you here.
Pleasure's mine.